Jennifer Foley.
I'm grateful to be here tonight. Craig Miller is an amazing person and someone who was very convincing. I've always wanted to share my experiences publicly, but didn't really have an opportunity. A lot of the time when I tell somebody one-on-one, they say, oh, you should write a book. And I don't know that I have the discipline to do that. So it's easier for me to stand in front of you tonight and give the version that fits into the time that we have. I'm grateful for my friend Janice, who is the reason I know about IONS. She told me and started coming last summer and have heard some amazing experiences. Craig mentioned I've had two experiences, which is not usual. I obviously survived them both and feel that although they weren't, I didn't see colors and lights and it wasn't as spectacular as I've heard. And I think that no two NDEs should be compared. Mine, I consider special and spiritual. I don't think that a particular religion was the reason that I'm still here. Faith and hope and love, they stand alone. There is a specific religion that I grew up in. It has nothing to do with why I'm here tonight or I'm not trying to change anybody's mind. Just wanted to share what happened to me. When I was 8 years old, my sister, who's 8 years older than myself, had a horse and she was into all that FFA kind of thing. We had a Native American girl who was the same age as my sister, about 16, 17, living with us like an exchange program. My parents decided they were going to take a vacation, and another couple who had their own jet, how nice would that be, decided to go to Florida and the Bahamas, and they took a vacation. And that Saturday, my sister Tracy, who owned the horse, had an event that she was at all day long. My live-in sister Karen decided to go ahead and take my sister Amy and I, who I was 8 years old, my sister Amy's 2.5 years younger, horseback riding for the day. However, she didn't ask my sister. She had us on the horse bareback and on a small two-lane highway where there weren't too many cars, and we were riding in the street but towards the soft shoulder. My sister has many memories of the being bareback and the horse trotting hard, and we just kind of didn't know what we were all doing. And a car, I always thought it was a big truck, but my sister recollects that it was just a normal sedan-type car, came down the street and spooked the horse. So nobody knows exactly why a horse gets spooked. There are many, many reasons, but it started bucking. And my sister was sitting in front of me. I was on the back. She grabbed onto the mane, which was smart because there was no saddle or anything else to hold on to, and it swung her into the soft grass, and she didn't have a scratch on her. Well, me, I'm more accident prone than that. So I held on for dear life, but there was really nothing to hold on to, and fell off the horse onto the back of my head in the street. Luckily, the horse didn't trample me. It just kind of took off and ran. My sister, Native American sister, she had no idea what to do. She actually felt like she should run the other way so she didn't get in trouble later on. But there I was, and the neighbor across the way heard the commotion of the horse and came out and realized she needed to call 911 and got an ambulance there. I had massive head trauma, brain hemorrhage that they didn't know. The city I grew up in California didn't have facilities in that hospital to properly take care of me. So they sent me up north about 40 miles and went to that hospital. They got my parents there finally and sat them down, and they'd done many tests, and I was in intensive care, and they said, we don't know what is going to happen to her. We don't even know if she'll make it through the night. So my parents were just, nobody wants to be on vacation and get that call, but they got there as quickly as they could, but the news was grim, and the brain scans showed massive hemorrhaging and clotting. And they just thought, well, if I did live, I probably wouldn't be very functional, more like a vegetative state for the rest of my life, or simply just not able to make it. So parents were panicked, of course, and they called everyone they knew and asked them to pray, which they did. And I think that had a lot to do with how things turned out. But they also gave me a blessing. And in that blessing, my father was given the impression that I was going to be fine, which made no sense to any of the doctors or anyone that was there. So through the night, my mom just stayed by my side. My dad just tried to comfort her with the knowledge that he felt he had. But it was a really rough night. The next morning, they continued to do the same series of tests that they had done before, which showed absolutely no damage whatsoever. The doctor, there are two doctors actually, but the one said, there is absolutely no medical explanation for this. And he was astounded. He just leaned against the wall and was in absolute shock. The nurses were crying. It had a profound effect on everyone who saw me as I came in, and then all that you could see was a little tiny bump on the back of my head. I still have that bump. It's a reminder. Then 10 years passed. I was fine. I was in second grade when that accident happened. I went back to school, and kids treated me like I was supernatural or something for a little while, but I think it's just people don't know what to do when someone, you know, passes through a situation like that and comes back. But many years later, as I'm a week before I turn 18, I had another near-death experience where I was typical, very rebellious teenager, and my mom did not approve of my boyfriend, so I was going to show her. So we butt heads often, and oh, it was awful for her. I've apologized many times to her since, but that day he had graduated a year ahead of me, and I was a senior. And that morning he had a paper he needed done, and he asked for me to come and help him. And he lived out in Bakersfield, California, where he was working at the oil refineries. And so he said, well, he's working and going to school. He says, well, doesn't your mom have one? You know, it's funny now because technology is so advanced, but he says, well, doesn't your, this is December 1st of 1988. And he says, well, didn't she just buy one of those typewriters that's fast? You know, the word processor of old, and she had. So I cut school and took her word processor and just thought I knew everything and got in the car. Well, he had a truck that was elevated. It was, you know, kind of jacked up as they were. And California at that time did not have a seatbelt law yet. And we never wore them, never thought about them, didn't think of the fact that we could ever be in an accident. But that morning as we got ready to go, he kind of firmly said, I think you need to put your seatbelt on. I said, well, I think you do too, blah, blah, blah. You know, we just argued about it. But so I said, okay, fine. So I put it on and I have my full seatbelt on. He decided, he was a tall person and he was 6'4", and he didn't like the lap part, so he threw that behind him. Had we not had our seatbelts on that exact way, it would have been fatal for both of us. But we got in the truck and started on our way and got out to, of course, the middle of nowhere in between Santa Maria, California, where I'm from, and Bakersfield. He decides he wants a cassette tape that's on my side of the car as the passenger. So he just, you know, he's got his hand on top of the wheel, involved no other car, but just reached down to get the tape and just starts rustling through what's on the ground. I said, I'll get it. And he started to go off the road, and I knew we were going to crash. So I screamed or, you know, went, ah! And so he overcorrected to get back on the road. When he did that, the truck simply flipped. So 4 times it rolled until it landed upside down. The first time it rolled, he had his window down. He didn't have the shoulder part on, so he was ejected after the first time the truck rolled 50 feet through the air and away from, luckily, the direction of the continuing rolling. But I, of course, as the passenger, was trapped by the seatbelt, which was a good and bad thing. It did damage to me, but it saved my life. And I ended up with a broken hip and femur and nose and lacerations all across the top of my head, debris, including my mom's new word processor, which was in pieces, flew throughout the vehicle. I had terrible damage to my face. You couldn't even tell who I was. So after the fourth roll, the truck landed in the middle of the road. Luckily, there's really no one around out there, but also no help. So it lands, and I can hear my boyfriend at the time yelling my name. But he sounded far, and I thought, I don't even know what happened. But he's calling for me. I could hear him, but knew he wasn't close enough to be there. And the engine was still running in the truck. Gas was pouring everywhere. It should have blown to pieces, but it didn't. I don't know even to number miracles, but that absolutely should have happened the way it had all been, but it didn't. It didn't blow up. And a trucker saw us and called and radioed for an ambulance, and an ambulance came. Well, they had to use the jaws of life to get me out of the truck. And as I hung there by the seatbelt, basically, I remember having a conversation with God, but there were no words. And literally, because of my pain and the amount of injury I'd sustained, I could not feel my body, so I thought, oh, I'm gone. So I literally thought that I was dead and just hanging there. And I thought, how sad that my boyfriend's over there yelling my name and I'm already gone. How sad that the ambulance is cutting me out, but I'm dead. But I had this conversation before they got to me with God without words. And that's the only way I can describe it, where there were communications going back and forth. I was saying, I don't deserve it. I know I cut school today. I know I've been mean to my mom. I know, you know, all the reasons that I should be in big trouble and didn't deserve it. But I pled. I said, you know, I'm not even 18 years old. I'm a week away. My birthday's December 8th, and I was begging to make it to at least that. But I also wanted to graduate high school. I wanted to go to college. I wanted to see my friends. I wanted to live life desperately. And I just begged and begged. And then I felt as though that privilege was granted to me. I don't remember exactly them cutting me out of the car, but as they wheeled us both into the back of the ambulance, he reached over and touched my arm, and that was when I knew I was still alive. And I thought, I can't believe it. I knew that I'd already had a near-death experience, so I thought I was out of chances. But there was definitely work for me left to do, and I couldn't have been more grateful. It was a 9-month recovery. I had a lot of physical therapy, a lot of pain to get better, to learn to walk again. My poor mom, we lived in a 2-story house, and the only shower and bathroom was upstairs. So she had to take a 3-4 week or month leave from work and nurse me back to health, even as awful as I had been to her before the accident, which is crazy, but she did it. It's amazing how much we love our loved ones at the time when tragedy strikes. But she took care of me, and I got through it, and I limped pretty good, but when I graduated high school, I sang with my partner as I planned, and I walked to get that diploma, and I couldn't have been more grateful. Since then, you know, I'm 43 now, and was barely 18 at the time. Boy, have I learned a lot of things through life experience that I didn't know, but I'm grateful every day, every single day, that I'm still here. That just still sometimes doesn't make sense to me. I have an amazing husband and daughter who are here tonight supporting me. My mom, I have, like I said, I've apologized to her until I'm blue in the face, and she said, you know, no apology necessary. I just am so glad you're still here, and I'm so glad that you made it through. I've been able to meet amazing people, do amazing things, and still have, Lord willing, many years ahead of me. I think that, again, when we want something, I had this conflict within myself whether or not I deserve to keep going. But I know from that point to now, God is extremely forgiving. And although we sometimes don't think before we act or speak, He loves each of us, every one of us. And I'm grateful that you came tonight. I'm grateful that I had a chance to speak.
For all of you that don't know me, my name's Robert Curtis. I've lived in Utah almost my entire life. Spent 3 years in Southern California when I was in high school. But what happened to me in 1992, I got just extremely, extremely ill. Into the doctors, it seemed like once a week, twice a week, and they were diagnosing me with muscle spasms, lower back pain, stomach cramps, just about everything that they could diagnose me with. In early January of 1993, I collapsed and they took me to the hospital. That's when I met a doctor here in Salt Lake, and he came and talked to me, and he says, I think that you have pancreatic cancer. And they started doing some tests, and after about a week, I started feeling much, much better. And I told him, I says, I want to go home. And he says, well, all right, you can go home if you want, but he says, I'm going to see you again really, really soon. And on the 2nd of February was my oldest son's birthday, and I'd been to his birthday party. And I went home, and I collapsed again, and back to the hospital in the ambulance. Doctor met me there. When they admitted me to the hospital, I weighed 119 pounds. I really thought I was going to die. I was in a lot of pain, and I thought, the only way I can feel better is if I die. And they started doing tests and doing tests, and the doctor came in after about a week, and he says, we're fairly certain that you have pancreatic cancer. He says, it's in its early stages. He says, we're really lucky that you got sick, if it's lucky that you can get sick. He says, we can operate on this, and we may be able to extend your life for a little while. He says, pancreatic cancer at that time, less than 1% of people with pancreatic cancer would survive. It was almost always fatal. And I said, well, I don't know if I'm ready to go yet or not, so let's do this. They started doing tests, and they map your body, look where all your blood veins and everything are at, so when they do the surgery, they're not cutting into something and making it worse than has to be. And after 15 days, they were ready to do the surgery. Before I start to tell you the story, I was in surgery for 11 hours. I went into surgery at 11 o'clock in the morning, and they finished the surgery at 10 o'clock that evening. And I was actually in the hospital for 38 days, 38 straight days in the hospital. And a couple of weeks after I got out of the hospital, I was back to see the doctor. And we were sitting there talking to him, and he says, I've got to be just really, really honest with you. He says, when you were in surgery, he said, you died. And I said, yes, I know. And he says, I want you to tell me what happened to you. When they took me to get me ready for surgery, they take you and they start prepping you, and they give you some sedatives to relax you. They took me into the operating room, and the anesthesiologist started putting me to sleep. And he started giving me some shots, and he says, I want you to count from 100 backwards. And I sort of remember 98. I had heard about near-death experiences, and I'd heard people that had gone through a long tunnel, or they had gone into a light, and that didn't happen to me. What happened to me is I remembered, I think, 98, and then it wasn't a room that I was in, it was just a place. And this place was the whitest white I'd never seen that white before. It was whiter than a brand new t-shirt. And it looked like a fog or a veil, whatever you want to call it. And I could see, I couldn't make the out any people, but I could see silhouettes of people moving behind this mist or this veil. And I wanted to go there very, very badly because I had never felt so comfortable and so at peace in my entire life. And I started to move towards that veil. My father had died about 4 months before that. And to this day, I'm convinced it was my father that told me, "You can't come yet, Robert. It's not time. You still have work to do." He said, "So you need to go back." And I found myself standing next to myself. I was laying in the hospital bed. They had me bundled up to where I couldn't move. Tubes in both arms, tube down my nostril, and there was machine breathing for me. And I was given one last chance. "You can decide right now. You can stay here or you can come back." And, well, here I am, so I must have decided to stay. And then I woke up, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning. I had no pain, and I still had that very comfortable feeling. And I remember feeling that I want to feel like this all the time. And I went back to sleep, and I woke up about 8 o'clock in the morning, and of course that comfortable feeling was gone, and there was extreme pain. This is just my feeling that the work that I still have to do, all of the shapes that I saw behind that mist or that veil were relatives that are waiting to have their genealogy and their church work done. And I've started doing that, and I've found many, many of my relatives that I didn't know that I had. And I think that this is the work that my dad told me that I still had to do. I actually believe that the kind of story that I have is much more common than bright lights and the colors. And I just think that what I had was just much more common an experience. And we don't want to talk about them because we don't feel like they're very important. But I guess they are. Thank you.
My name is Sandra Cherry. I'm on the board, as Martin mentioned to you. When I was in graduate school, I did my thesis in near-death studies. And what I wanted to know was, what kind of impact do near-death experiences have on people? Not just the person who has them, like Robert and Jennifer, but persons like you. How many of you sitting here have come or often enough or read about or studied about near-death experiences over a period of time? Raise your hand. How many of you would say that just because you have been exposed, read about, or studied, that it has impacted a change in your life? Raise your hand. I should have brought my research work. While I was a graduate student, I did a paper on the social self and the near-death experience and how powerful it is. So I'm going to ask Jennifer and Robert some questions, and it might take up some of your questions when I do. My master's degree is in general psychology. So one of the most amazing things to me is when I was doing my graduate work, I decided that if somehow I could get a pill and give everybody a pill that literally would produce a near-death experience in them, I could change the world. I haven't found a way to put this into a pill form, but I really am very, very deeply convinced that a very slight near-death experience, as you might call it, not as deep as other persons' near-death experiences, can have still a very profound effect. And so that's what I'm going to talk to you about tonight. So first, though, I'd like to ask Jennifer. Jennifer, can you tell me what are some of the differences in yourself? What do you perceive your experience, how did it affect your personality, and how you see the world?
First of all, definitely humility. The age that I was at the car accident, And the attitude that I had even minutes before, it dissipated. I became a very humble person, very grateful, much more loving and patient.
Let me ask you this. Is this when you came that close to death after the accident and you knew you were supposed to stay, do you feel that just that in itself gave you a hope that there was something more than just death?
Yes. It confirmed that to me that there is a God, absolutely, because I, like I said, it's a conversation without words that I had, but as a gift, he allowed me to come back. And I've never questioned that ever since.
How do you feel about death now?
I mean, I want to live. I hope to be old and and falling apart when I finally do pass. I definitely don't have the fear, because so many people before, if they've never had such an experience, see death as the end, or they fear it like I did at the time, because I knew I was doing a lot of things I shouldn't have been doing as a teenager. So I was fearful of the consequences that I might find. And that was, I think, the religion that had been taught since I was very small.
I perceive that you felt loved. Now, another question. What about your self-esteem? Teenagers really have struggles with self-esteem. How did you then see yourself?
Definitely felt worthiness. I felt individual worth, worthy enough that I could be given that gift, worthy enough that I could go on and make a difference in the world and had work to do, and I would eventually make a difference to my family, to my friends, to many other
people. You gained a great deal of confidence.
Yes.
Wow.
That I did not have before.
That's, okay. We'll talk a little bit about that. I will share more near-death experiences that will help you to understand this. Okay, Robert. Now, Robert, your experience, you say, was short, but I got to tell you, that's a pretty powerful thing to go through. I don't consider it short. And let me explain to you, there's such a thing as a core near-death experience. Core near-death experiences means that there are about 20 characteristics of a near-death experience, 10 that are pretty profound and common. And a person who has four of those, say 10, they are considered to have had a core near-death experience. You had at least three of the 10. So in spite of your perception that it was short and not like others, it is very profound. What was the difference in you that you perceived after having had this experience?
Well, I want everybody to know, growing up here in Utah and being a member of the predominant religion here in the state, but at the time, I was not a nice person. I was absolutely not a nice person.
Very similar to how Jennifer felt about herself.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And
you seem like a nice person.
Thank you. And after, for a long time, I don't think I changed for a long time.
Why? What had to happen to get that change? Did something traumatic, or was it the memory of the near-death experience, or the?
Well, it was probably the memory, because I didn't think about it for a long time.
Okay, good. I'm glad you clarified that.
But
you kind of put it away.
I did.
I don't want to even know that I went and saw him, because then it'll mess up my life.
Well, sure. At the time, I wanted to think that it was just a dream. If it would have just been a dream, I'm sure that I would have just forgotten about it by
now. That's right.
And as far as changes, I'm not afraid to die. I know that there's more than just this.
How about your self-confidence, your spirituality?
I'm much more spiritual now than I was. And my self-confidence, I'm really surprised that I'm sitting here. I'm not a public speaker.
You've done very well.
My self-confidence, it's much better. Mm-hmm. When I'm given a task, I won't quit until it's done.
It changed your personality, the way you see the world.
Absolutely.
The most powerful thing that you shared with us tonight was that you knew you had a mission. You might not have wanted to know it at the time, but eventually when the powerful awareness that this was very real and you can't put it under the carpet, then you perceived that you had a mission.
Yes.
An absolute. You're very fortunate, because not everybody after a near-death experience will have that profound awareness of what their mission is. But most of them will know that they are supposed to fulfill a mission. How many of you in here, have you ever thought about, what am I here for? What is it I'm supposed to be doing? It really kind of rocks your boat, because do you float from thing to thing, or have you discerned what it is that you're here for? What is the purpose of your life? And once you come to that realization, life somehow falls into place. I perceive that even though you didn't say you knew you had a specific mission, I'm hearing you say that your mission was to be kind and good and love people and to serve others. I mean, that's what am I right?
I think otherwise I would have been a very self-centered person.
Teenagers can be.
Well, I mean, I was as a teenager.
But you could see the road.
Yeah, was yeah. That I would have been a completely different person otherwise.
That is fascinating. Okay, now I'm going to read to you a near-death experience that's quite incredible. This is Kenneth Ring, and Kenneth Ring is one of the foremost authorities in near-death experiences, and his research in near-death studies was quite profound. Some of you older people remember the Donahue Show? Oh, I'm so glad to see some people shake. Okay, thank you. Well, Ken Ring was invited to be on the Donahue Show after he had submitted some research that he had done, and it became very famous, and he and Raymond Moody were friends. Ken Ring and Raymond Moody were the catalyst that started the IONS organization years ago. So I want to read to you something that really affected Ken. He says that of all the near-death experiences that he had heard over many, many years, as well as many letters from people telling about their near-death experiences, this one affected him deeply. And I'd like to share it with you and then open up some questions that you could ask me about, or these our panelists here, about the effect of near-death experiences. Of all the beautiful letters I have received, I think the one that touched me the most profoundly was written by a woman who resides with her family in the Midwest. In July 1981, four NDEers and I appeared on the Donahue Show, and Anne happened to see it. Doing so prompted her to write. Her letter begins. I watched you on the Donahue Show today with a great deal of interest, because I am also one of those people who have experienced the peace and absolute love of the spiritual existence. I volunteer my own experience to your study because, in addition to creating a total change in my personality, I was given information that literally saved me from suffering the terrible grief of the death of my husband and two children later. Now, what I want you to think about as I'm reading this is, what could be more painful than losing loved ones? And so when we talk about changes in personality, how deep do these changes go? And that's what's fascinating to me, is they literally, these changes, this paradigm shift goes to the core of the being. I'm just so profoundly affected by that. I was 22 years old, delivering my second child, a little girl. The date was June 18th, 1954. I began to hemorrhage badly, but I recall a great pain in my chest that was making it impossible for me to draw in more air after exhaling. I recall a sense of being pulled up by some great force out of the room toward a bright light, which seemed far away at first, but I flew toward it very swiftly. The pain fell behind me like ribbons or streamers trailing me, as I knew I was going faster and faster. The light appeared to be a window of some kind, and I was momentarily alarmed that I would be hurt as I crashed into it. But because I could not possibly stop myself in time at such high speed, I automatically shut my eyes and braced myself for the crash, which was unavoidable, I thought. Nothing crashed. I suddenly stopped and felt myself lying perfectly still, like floating on water. My sense of belonging, love, peace, and well-being was indescribable. It was absolute, perfect, wonderful. I didn't know where I was, but I didn't care. I would be content to stay there forever. I was alone, but not lonely. Even though there were no visual means of determining my position in this environment of nothing, I knew I was lying down rather than standing up. Then I received the knowledge. No one was there with me, and no one spoke as we speak, that I was to wait there until a person came to talk to me. Then I knew He was on his way toward me from an unthinkable distance away. He came to me at an unthinkable high speed, passing through the universe, through whole galaxies to come where I was. I was in a world of total nothingness except myself. The bright light I had seen at first as a window in a world of total darkness was all about me now, but not bright anymore, now soft and soothing, or perhaps no light at all, but no darkness either. More a haze. I felt so very, very comfortable here. I'm going to interrupt myself to say, someone spoke to you, but nobody was there.
The conversation that I felt I had about whether or not I was going to come or go required no words, and I didn't actually see him. Mm-hmm. I just had that.
Okay. I sensed the person approached toward me, and I knew the exact instant he entered into the outer edge of the world, or my state of awareness that I was in. He came to me from my right-hand side. In a matter of seconds, he entered my world, hundreds and thousands of light years away, and traveled to my side and took hold of my right hand. When he took hold of my hand, I immediately knew him to be the greatest friend I had. I also knew that I was a very special person to him. The thrill of this touch of hands exceeds anything I have ever experienced on Earth, in life as we know it. Our meeting was understood, sensed, not visual. Without vocal communication, he told me he had come for my child. My child? I asked, scarcely able to contain my joy and happiness over the news that one of my children would be going back with him. It was, I knew, a very high honor to be selected for this. I had the honor of being the mother of a very extra special child. I was so proud that he had picked my child. We were discussing her life, not death. It was a fantastic opportunity for my child, and it never occurred to me to refuse to give my child to this man. Thus, I gave my child to him, or I meant to do so immediately, but I could not do this because I then realized, with great disappointment, my child was not with me. I had no child to give him. I started to cry over the loss of such a great opportunity as this. No child to give. I was a mother with no child. It seemed such a terrible thing to have no child to give to this man. I was about to be devastated by my own sorrow over such a great loss of this wonderful opportunity for my child, if I had a child right then to give him. But I didn't, and I didn't know why I didn't, because I knew I was a mother. He patted my hand in sympathy and reassured me that I was a mother and I did have a child, but the child must have been delayed somehow. Then he waved his hand across the space in front of us and the haze cleared. I could see the nurses and doctor and my baby back in the delivery room. The doctor was examining the baby and laying it on a scale-like machine, which was supposed to indicate its lifespan rather than its weight. We could see that the machine was malfunctioning and giving the doctor a false reading. The doctor gave the baby to the nurse, saying it would live to be 80 years old. But the man with me is shaking his head, saying to me, "Men put so much faith in their own machines, they fail to notice the truth. The machine is wrong. The child will live for only 4 days." "Would my child live 80 years if the machine was fixed?" I asked. "Yes, but they don't know that it is not working properly." "Then I'll let them know. When I go back, I'll tell them." "No, you won't remember any of this when you go back." "Then I don't want to go back. I want to go with you." "No, I came for your child. It is not time for you to come with me now. You must go back." "But what about my child?" "I will return for your child in 4 days." And this statement filled me with joy again. With this promise, I was willing to go back. I was perfectly willing to go back and wait for my own turn while my child went first. I had not seen as we see on earth or held this child in my arms yet, but I felt such an overwhelming love for this child. I would have sacrificed anything for her. Going back was a sacrifice. Or so it seemed to me then. "I'm going to tell them about that faulty machine when I go back." "You won't remember." "I will. I must." Most people never remember this place when they go back. Even if they do, they won't believe you. It is probably best that you don't remember rather than be disbelieved. No, I will remember. Whether anyone believes me or not doesn't matter. I must remember this place. He let go of my hand, and I felt myself falling away from him, moving downward quite fast, looking back to where he was, saying over and over, "I'll remember, I'll remember." Then someone was screaming my name and slapping my face on my cheeks back and forth, and I was still concentrating so hard on what I intended to remember that I didn't answer to my name. I knew I was back in the delivery room now and fully aware of the nurse bending over me, slapping my cheeks, and calling me by my name. But I didn't answer her. I'd forget what I was trying so hard to remember. Somehow I knew that if I answered her, I'd forget everything. So I didn't answer. Deliberately didn't answer her. Then she said, "Your baby is here." And that caught me off guard. I wanted to see my baby just once before she left me. I answered, "But I must remember," which made no sense to the nurse, which she later told me. In that instant of speaking to her, I totally forgot it all. I wanted to see my baby. Anne's letter continues with a description of her next few days in the hospital. Her own situation, she discovered, had indeed been critical. But the outcome for both mother and child, she named her daughter Tari, appeared positive. Nevertheless, she continued to feel that there was something she was supposed to tell her physician about her baby, but simply could not remember it. On the second day, her physician detected severe cerebral hemorrhaging in the baby, who was now paralyzed on her right side, and he knew, according to what he later told Anne, that she would probably die. He tried to prepare Anne for the news, but did so in a gentle, indirect manner. Nevertheless, at this point, Anne was totally unconcerned about her baby's state of health. "I persisted in concentrating on some elusive thing that I was supposed to remember to tell him. Still, I heard and understood all that he said to me. What I failed to do was feel worried about it, or frightened, or sad. That sense of peace and well-being seemed to come back with me, though I remembered nothing and could not explain why. I was not worried about my baby daughter and how I knew that she was going to be all right. It was contrary to physical facts." On the morning of the fourth day, June 22nd, Tari died. "That morning," Anne writes, "she woke up suddenly, fully alert. I sensed something had happened to me, but I didn't know what it was." Because her physician had noted her strangely serene attitude about Tari's impending death, he had given the staff strict orders that none of them should break the news to Anne. He himself would do it. It didn't work out that way, and Anne found herself ready to be discharged. She was explaining to one of the nurses that she had to sign papers first when it was apparent that the nurse was devastated. She knew Tari was dead and that I didn't. "Oh, God," she wailed. "Your doctor should have been here by now. I'm not supposed to tell you. But I can't let you go on believing Tari is alive. She died early this morning." In the time it took her to get up from her desk and come to me, taking hold of my shoulders, I completely remembered it all in detail. Relived it almost exactly. I suppose I looked strange to the nurse. "Are you okay?" she asked. "Yes," I told her, much too calm under the circumstances. "This is the fourth day, right?" And I felt joy. In the weeks following, I felt no grief of my own loss, but I felt sorry for my friends and relatives who didn't know where Tari was and couldn't believe, really believe, that my experience was anything more than a vivid dream. Her husband and her doctor, who had other patients who had experienced NDEs, though they were not, of course, called that in 1954, they both acknowledged, however, that something real had happened to Anne, but not her minister. Her minister said, "He pronounced this experience as a hallucination, common to persons undergoing great stress. There was no such thing as leaving this life and going to another and coming back here again. It was a psychological defense mechanism, he said, and I would be better off to simply forget all about it so that my natural grief period could begin and so that my life could go back to normal. This conversation with my minister almost wiped me out, but I obeyed him without question, or tried to at least. In a matter of months, I had not been able to forget it. Was well on my way to thinking myself to be some kind of freak. It would have been easier, I think, to try to forget my own name than to forget that wonderful feeling, surge of sheer joy I had felt when he took my hand and told me he had come for my child. That was the greatest moment I had ever known. I still don't know who he was, nor do I care. I only know he exists. Well, I soon realized that my acceptance back into this world depended on pretending to forget and pretending to grieve the loss of my baby. So I did this for everybody else's sake, except my husband, who believed me and gained some comfort from it secondhand. It was a dropped subject, but never forgotten. Now this is how Anne concludes her letter. So you know, I listened very intently to the people you appeared with on the Donahue show, and of course, I don't simply believe they had some kind of real experience. I know they did. It all rang so true to me, and I also understand the terrible difficulty in trying to verbalize it afterwards in a way that others can believe it. You have to water it down so much. I have not been very successful at this. Thank you for listening by reading all this. Then she added this postscript. I had 3 more children after Tari's birth. My beloved husband died in my arms at home 16 years later. My firstborn son lived to be 25 and was killed in a car accident. Instantly, no time for pain or suffering. That was 7 years after the death of my husband. My grief was softened and shortened each time. People said, she's in shock now. She'll grieve more later. Later, they said. She must be a very strong person to live through what she's had to live through so calmly. Neither statement was true. It feels good to tell the truth to someone. They aren't dead. They are all alive, busy and waiting for me. Our separation is only temporary and very short compared to all of eternity. I can't think of a more profound change than to know, as she knows, that the people she loves are in a place so wonderful and so much better than actually here. That's what I think is so beautiful. Some of the things that people found that they significantly changed in their lives. One is their spiritual growth. Another is their love, the sense of love, being loved, and being able to love others. Knowing God, knowing he exists. A sense of inner peace. A sense of being more responsible and caring. No fear of death. Deepened beliefs. Life of service, self-understanding, no fear, thirst for knowledge, greater awareness, open attitude, ability to feel, and not introverted. Interesting that Robert said he didn't believe years before he would have been able to get up here and talk. He's not a speaker, yet he did wonderful, and I thought that was amazing when you said that. Tell me, when we talk about not introverted and changing, does this spark any awareness in you as I've said some of these things?
Absolutely. When I was in high school, I was just really introvert. I had friends, but not a lot of friends. And there was no chance that I would put myself out there and introduce myself to somebody. And now I have no problem walking up to somebody and introducing myself, shaking their hand.
I was shy when I was very young, but I kind of realized as I got to be maybe 10, 12 years old, it just wasn't working. I remember having a kind of an epiphany of thinking, I don't want to be ignored. I don't want everyone else to have opportunities that I won't get because I don't speak up or I don't relate to people, or, you know, I remember thinking that.
Do you think coming so close to death at a younger age that there was some awareness that, I mean, Did that change you, that first experience, when you were a girl?
Yeah.
A young girl?
Well, as I mentioned, when I was in second grade and when I went back to school, it happened in February of second grade. And when I went back, people were afraid of me. They didn't know what to say to me. I was treated like I was some kind of supernatural being. Because I had almost passed on and then came back. And people, I think they were just scared and unsure of how to treat me or what to say. But I felt very isolated and kind of odd for about a month, and then it went away. It got easier. But
do you know, this is really interesting because, especially Robert, you said it was a while before you accepted and the impact of your near-death experience really hit you. The average years it takes after a person has had a near-death experience is 7 years to integrate it into your life. How many of you would think that your relationships with your loved ones would be better after a near-death experience or worse?
The person who has the NDE has to have time to integrate it as well.
7 whole years, yes?
Yes. But the extraordinary thing is there are no words to describe the feeling and the emotion and the immediacy of what you experienced. And a lot of people don't talk about it for a long time because they don't know what it means, they don't know how to cope, and they don't want people to think they're strange. That inability to communicate what happened, what they experienced, has to have time to settle in. And it can actually alienate you from your loved ones because you shut up about it. Yet, part of you is going through this extraordinary spiritual growth.
Oh, very good. Excellent. Now, I'll tell you a story about a young woman. I don't know how many of you have been here when Kimberly Clark Sharp has been here, but Kimberly told me this story. She was in this hospital, and a gentleman had come in, and he'd been brought in because he had died of a heart attack. So they were able to revive him. This man was a very, very accomplished attorney. He was married, and he had children. He has a near-death experience. It immediately changes his perception of the world and of what's important. He wasn't very old because he had young children. His wife comes to the hospital. I can remember Kimberly saying to me something to the effect that she suggested to the wife, now your husband has gone through something, because she had talked to him and knew that he had a near-death experience. She told the woman that he's going to be different than he was before. She was a little apprehensive as to what did this mean. She told the man, she counseled him that for 1 year he should not make any big changes or decisions. Right away, he went home and he told his wife that he really wasn't happy being an attorney, that he really wanted to open a homeless shelter and take all their savings out to build this homeless shelter. Now, this is a woman who drives an SUV, has 3 great kids, and wears a great ring and has a swimming pool probably in her backyard and a number of other things. And then this guy is saying, well, you know, we really just need to get rid of all this because we're supposed to be helping people and loving them and doing our best to serve others. And she's like, who are you? That, by the way, is an extreme example of what we mean when we're talking about someone changing. What's interesting is not all people change instantly. Each individual with their personality, their experiences, their perceptions, their concepts of what life is about really, really affects how they perceive it, how they utilize it in their lives, and what they do with it, and how long it takes for that integration to take place. I would say, Jennifer, yours was almost instantaneous. But I also will say, I believe that one reason is because of her experience when she was younger. It had prepared her in some ways to accept fully this incredible thing. Robert here, and you can say yes or no, he resisted this spiritual side of himself. He pushed it away for a long time. And so when he had that near-death experience, it was much more comfortable for him to put it on the shelf because it meant your life would have to change dramatically if you integrated it right then. The other thing I wanted to share with you before I open it up to some questions is I did my research and I handed out questionnaires to people like you, those who've had near-death experiences, but especially people who are interested in them and want to learn about them. And what I found was, first of all, that these are the places that people change the most. And then you both can address any of these that you perceive to be things that, oh yeah, that's something I know. So one was a belief in the authenticity of near-death experiences. Almost all people exposed to them for any length of time will come away saying, was it real or was it a dream? Why do you know it was real?
It's a deep-seated acceptance, but there was no way I questioned it.
How about you, Robert?
It's because this happened in 1993, and that's been 22 years ago, and it's never changed.
A hallucination or a dream? Both of those things fade, especially in detail. Hallucination is usually gone almost immediately. But a person who has a dream, you can remember parts of the dream. And it's sometimes very hard to even remember dreams. But you might be able to say, oh, I remember when I was 10 years old, I had a dream of falling. But the details, no. Like, just like this woman whose NDE I just read to you, the details remain so clear. And the other thing is, everyone who we have done research and talked to says it was more real than life itself. Okay, the other thing we found and we talked about is fear of death is gone. Wouldn't that be wonderful to not fear death? But death itself to them is almost wonderful. It's like an invitation. The other thing is their view of death has changed. It's more positive. They believe in life after death. They have a spiritual orientation. Now, this is really interesting. Religiosity goes down, but spirituality goes up. People who are very religious don't feel that religion is as important as their spiritual being, their spiritual relationship with God. Religion and all of those things that go with it are, to some, they remain important, but they aren't the primary thing that they focus on. Am I right there?
Religion now is much more important than it was then.
Right.
Then it wasn't even...
It didn't even matter.
It didn't matter. And now it does.
But do you think when you say religion, are you saying that the spiritual growth that it brings is what's important?
Both.
Both. So for you, it was both.
Yeah.
Very good. Okay, belief in God. And this is it. This is really one. Belief in purpose of life. And when I did my research, I went to the University of Connecticut, BYU. I went to UVSC at the time. I then came here to IONS and surveyed hundreds and hundreds of people to see what changes happened when people were exposed to near-death experiences. All of these areas in which I did research to look and see what the percentage of change. People changed over and over and over again. The other area was a decrease in materialism. Instead, an increase in what you can do for others is very profound. I've seen in my own heart changes. I had a smaller experience, outer body experience, and much smaller, Robert. At the time my child was being born, I had a cesarean section. And when they took me into the operating room after I had had 19 caudals, anybody remember what caudals are? Today they're called epidurals. They're probably different medication. But I had had 19, if you can even imagine that. 16 prior to when they finally decided that they needed to take my child C-section. So they took me in. They gave me 3 caudals right then and there because they want, and I think most of you know that you're supposed to be awake when your child is going to be born, because if they put you out, it reduces the child's, or it increases the child's risk. They find that the child doesn't have the opportunity to breathe. I'm not sure what the correlation is, but it does make a difference. And just as they went to start the surgery, they had shaved, I don't know why, there's no hair on my tummy, but they shaved my tummy. And when they were shaving my tummy, I said, oh, that, I can feel that. And the doctor said, you're kidding. 3 caudals had not worked. And my blood pressure had dropped, so they decided they had to put me out. and they put me out. I was gone, and all I know is that I lost numerous, I think she, they told me afterwards, 3 pints of blood. They didn't expect me to live because my blood pressure had dropped so low, and I was dying. They sent a nurse out to tell my husband that they didn't expect me to live. The baby was fine. They had showed him the baby and taken the baby, you know, to the nursery already. Next thing I remember was being wheeled down the hall and seeing my husband. During the time that I was in this point where they felt dying, this incredible light, just beautiful, just sustained me, and this sense of peace and love came over me. I just remember feeling this incredible emotion. That day, they showed me my baby, and then they took him, and then they said, you need to sleep. I woke up in the morning, and I had blood coming out of both of my ears, and I had ruptured my eardrums. And what they decided was that I had 2 dormant ear infections, and when they gave me massive amounts of antibiotics before the surgery, it caused my eardrums to burst. That meant that they put me in isolation. So I was all alone in a room, and the only person who could come and see me was my husband, and he had to have white mask and all this stuff. But while I was laying there alone, the most incredible thing happened. I'm laying in the bed, and all of a sudden, I could just raise up out of the bed. It was so good because I didn't hurt anymore. No pain. I could lay there and just leave. And it was awesome, because when you're in pain, it's so nice to escape. My husband came in a couple days later. I mean, he'd been in and out. But so finally we were alone, and he came in, and I said, I got to tell you something. And he said, what? I said, you're going to think I'm crazy, but this is so awesome. I said, I want you to watch me. Okay, Martin, you heard this before, no? I said, I want you to watch. And I'm laying there, and I did it. I mean, I raised above the bed. He said, what do you want me to see? And I said, I was, you know, back as fast as he said it. And I said, I can raise myself out. And when I'm out, I'm in no pain, absolutely no pain. That's my experience. I never even remembered it, never recalled it, until I was working with Ken Ring, and we had been working all morning, and we'd gone to lunch, and Ken was sitting across from me at lunch, and he said to me, Sandy, you've had a near-death experience. And I said, no, I haven't. And he said, I just sense that something's happened to you. And that was when it all came back, and I remembered. It was just amazing. That I share with you to confirm exactly what you went through, which was that powerful experience came back to you and changed your life. When he said that to me, it encouraged me to continue my research. I do know, beyond a doubt, that what these people experienced was as real as you and I here tonight. If you get a chance, go and see Heaven is Real. It was so good. Okay, now I'm going to give these 2 people and you a chance to ask us all questions.
I don't have a question so much as a comment where you were talking about the experience feels more real than reality. The key is visceral. Everything that I've read about, all the stories that I've been told. Also, most people at some point in their life have had a spiritual experience of some kind, whether it's an out-of-body experience, whether it's a psychic communication, all sorts of different things.
Spiritual.
Spiritual in nature. The reason that it makes so much difference in how we think in general is because it is physically visceral, and that's why we don't forget it either.
I'd like to ask Robert, what did the doctor tell you had happened when he knew that you died? Explain all that.
After I'd told my story, it's not that I had forgotten it, I just forgot to mention it. When I was sitting there talking with the doctor, and he said, you know, you died when you were in surgery. And he told me that, he said, your heart quit twice. He says, the first time it just fluttered, just a few seconds. He says, the second time, and I think this is when I had my near-death experience, he says, we had to shock your heart to get you back.
Doctor, believe your experience? What did What was his reaction? Did you tell him about your NDE?
I did, and he sat there and just and kind of just nodded. Yeah.
Do you think he believed you?
I don't think he believed me when I told him what had happened to me. A man of science.
Yeah.
My understanding is that people who have had these experiences and want to go back to the other side, they understand at the same time that suicide is not an option, even if they attempted suicide and that's what led to them having that experience. Did you find that confirmed in your research?
Yes. In fact, it's amazing because people who wanted to die and even attempt suicide after the near-death experience, they recognize, first of all, how valuable life is, even though they want to go back. Now, that doesn't mean all people. I know I've talked to a few people who I've interviewed who have had a really difficult time. They long so much to go back. Ken Ring said something really powerful to me. He said that after a person has had a near-death experience, if they do not integrate it into their life, if they continue to fight and see it as two different worlds, but not take what they've learned from it and utilize it to create a better world for themselves, a better life for themselves and others, then that's when they struggle. And also, one other thing, not being believed, the difference, we don't know, but had Robert said to that doctor, this is what I experienced, and had that doctor said back to Robert, oh my gosh, I've had many patients who've had this wonderful experience. It is real. It's beautiful. I am so impressed. Tell me about how you feel and what exactly happened, and asked him more details and confirmed and validated it. We don't know how that would have affected Robert at the time. They all know, they will all say, suicide is not an acceptable way to return. Robert specifically was told that he had a purpose. He had some work to do, right? Well, that in itself gives you an indication that there's a reason you're here and you're supposed to stay here until it's your time. The other thing is, in all of these near-death experiences, many of them, they're told it's not your time. By the way, I'm sure that was your dad.
Thank you.
I'm sure. And he said to him, it's not your time. It's not your time, Robert. So what does that imply to you? If you take your own life, you're going to cut short your time. And so that is really a profound thing. It seems to be very true. Data indicates that people all say, even those that have tried to commit suicide, that that's not the choice. Anybody read Return from Tomorrow? Okay, do you remember Return from Tomorrow? Do you remember that when George Ritchie was walking down the street? Remember he was trying to return to go to medical school? And so he decided to go on his own in his spirit body, and he's going over the city, and he wants to know where he is because he's trying to get from Texas to Maryland. And he stops, and he sees a blinking light open, and it's a bar, and it's late at night. Do you remember this scene? You remember what happened in this scene? Which really taught him an incredible lesson. He went into the bar. He sees all these people there drinking and smoking. They're having a wonderful time. They're all there. And he sees these spirit beings trying to grab the cigarettes out of their hands or get the smoke in their mouth. You know. And then others who want the drinks. They want the alcohol. And their hands couldn't get the bottle or the glass. And he could feel their frustration. Well, that was one thing. He said after he realized he couldn't get any answers out of them because he asked them questions and nobody answered him because he just didn't see him. He went outside and he's walking down the street. A sweet lady walking down the street. She was an older lady and you could tell she was sad, very sad. And she was real, not a spirit. And behind her was a young boy and he was a spirit. And he kept saying, Mom, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't know what I was doing when I took my life. And he was begging her to forgive him. If you've had someone commit suicide in your life, one of the most powerful gifts you can give, from what my understanding is forgiveness. Is to know that once you release them, and this is what George Ritchie said, is once that mother came to terms with the pain and would release her son, he would be free to go on, to move on. Isn't that beautiful? So what holds that boy was her sorrow and pain, and he came back because he wanted to soothe her. And what a powerful gift we can give to forgive.
I was wondering about your first experience when you were 8 years old. Did I miss something? Did you tell us about talking to, you know, the other side, Jesus or anything?
It was the car accident when I was almost 18 that I had the conversation with God. The first time, it was an absolute miracle that, because they felt, you know, the damage done to my brain was going to be permanent, if not fatal. And in my case, the doctor was absolutely converted. He had been agnostic and never thought much, had a medical reason for everything, and he was just blown away.
So it that was a total miracle to be able to return mm-hmm. like that. But did you experience anything seen in heaven? Or
I don't think I needed that. I think that is given to those that need that experience. For some reason, in neither of my near-death experiences did I see a light, see color, see God or Jesus Christ. I didn't have those kind of, and I'm not at all downplaying those that have had that happen, because that's their own.
I just want to thank you for what you just said, because I was in an accident and they told me I wasn't supposed to live. And the thing is, with my accident, I was conscious the whole time, and I had to walk back to the vehicle and call 911 to come out and take me, because I was bleeding to death. I was sitting there trying to analyze what you had said, what she just asked you about your experience in that, because I have a strong faith in Jesus too, and kind of like trying to reason and rationalize, like, oh, was I cheated? I didn't go off somewhere.
Where was the light?
Yeah. So I really appreciate your question and your answer, because that really helped me, because I was sitting there with the doctor and he's telling me, he goes, if you wasn't sitting across the table from me after looking at your x-rays and this and that, and I would say this person is not among the living. And he goes, God has given you a second chance in life. I don't know why or for what reason, but you shouldn't have lived through this accident. So I really appreciate this. My first time here, and I got some good answers. Cause
I'm glad.
That's why we're here. Thank you so much. I just want to comment. Miracles are profound. They change lives. I just can't think of a more incredible miracle that would profoundly change a little girl's life. That is an amazing thing.
Have you done much exploring people who have been going in and out from while they're in the process of dying, someone who's aged, and having experiences and coming back and sharing them and then going again?
Raymond Moody wrote a book about near-death visions, and one of the most powerful things is, again, people who not especially died, as profound as these people, they have these incredible experiences where they actually have deceased family come to them, or they are taken to different places where they see things that they couldn't have seen any other way except that they had left their body. That does occur. I just read something interesting when I was doing my research today, looking through these books. I read something interesting about the fact that some people seem to be more prone, more actually predisposed to seeing the other side, or being predisposed to having visions or dreams that change their lives. And I almost envy that. I think it's really an amazing thing. And what's amazing is most of the times when we seek it, it doesn't come. It's when we let go and we're comfortable in ourselves that these things occur.
Well, the reason I brought it up is because when my father was passing, it was 8 years ago, and the last 8 days of his life, he would go to the other side, and for a period of 47 hours, he never quit talking to us, and he was sharing with us what he was seeing and what he was experiencing, and it went on for days, and he was very, very verbal. And the one day the doctor came in and he says, Marv, how are you? And he looked at him and he said, do you know who I am? And he says, yes, you're my doctor. And gave him his name, and he says, well, how are you doing? And he says, I'm in between. And for 8 days, he was coming back and forth and sharing with his whole family what he was seeing and experiencing. It changed all of our lives.
Thank you. She said it changed all of our lives, because as you witness that, people who are laying there and they're, you know, they're leaving, and all of a sudden they say, oh, my grandma just came into the room, so be quiet, I have to listen to her. And you're going, okay. But it does. It changes everybody. It's a beautiful, beautiful gift. And it seems to be very common as persons near death. And you have to get that book, Parting Visions by Raymond Moody. You will love it. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who wrote about approaching death, one of the things she did find was as people approached death that they did have visitations, that they had great opportunities to be at peace. Now, I'll tell you one last story, and then Jack Benny. Were you here when I told about Jack Benny? Jack Benny was a comedian. Jack Benny was on his deathbed, and it was, they knew that he was going to pass away. And his son wrote a book about Jack Benny. And at the very end, this is the story he told. He said, it was a few days before my father was going to die, and my dad was really scared, and he was very agitated about dying, very, very much so. And he tried to soothe his father, but there was no soothing him. And it was 2 days or something like that before his dad died that the son came into the bedroom. And Jack Benny was smiling and just happy and totally at ease. And all of the agitation and all of that terrible feeling that you have from your loved one, that they're in a lot of emotional pain, was gone. And he said, Dad, how are you? What's happened? And he said, it's okay, son. It's okay. I know it's beautiful. I've seen the other side, and it's beautiful. And he said 2 days later, his father died in complete peace. We're so lucky to live in this world in which we have instant information. And we are able, I did research in which I looked back at how long ago were near-death experiences actually recorded. And it goes back to the time of Plato. But we have only snippets of stories that were written. And then as time goes by, we have some from 400 A.D., that were written by monks about their near-death experiences. These have been going on throughout time. And what makes them so profound is that we find them in all religions, in all cultures, and throughout all time. And so we're talking about something that's real. And we're so fortunate to have the knowledge today that we can go into a computer and look up this information. And we can, for ourselves, determine, does this give us peace and knowledge and understanding? We're lucky, aren't we, that we can have this? It's beautiful. Jennifer, thank you. And Robert, thank you. You give us hope and insight and inspiration. And thank all of you. We really appreciate you.